Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's October 11, 2013. You're listening to the best PokerCast on the interwebs. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott, frequent flyer mile long. Oh, man. Well, you know, hey, I'm back from another one of my crazy trips, Chris. Yeah. And I know you always get bothered when I'm back here because I pester you.
Yes.
When I'm back in the office. When I'm on the road, it's like bliss for you, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
But I'm back in the office now, but not for too long. I just got back from Pittsburgh. But all of our fans are going to have to tune in next week to hear about that, because today we're ready to make a, drum roll, major announcement about the 2014 Ante Up Poker Tour. And for the announcement, we've invited our good friend Ben Irwin, Director of Poker Operations at Thunder Valley Casino Resort near Sacramento, California, to join us. How you doing this morning, Ben?
Scott, doing great. Chris, hello. How are you?
Hey, buddy.
Great to be with you.
All right, well, let's get right to it. Ante Up and Thunder Valley are excited to announce that the 2014 Ante Up World Championship will be at Thunder Valley next summer. And in addition, the Ante Up NorCal Classic will return for its third year in November 2014. And, of course, this year's NorCal Classic runs from November 7th to the 18th. Whew, that's a lot to talk about today. But we have to talk about the World Championship first, Ben. How excited is the Thunder Valley team to host this event for us in 2014?
This is the event that we wanted to host for you guys. We're excited about the tour. The response that we got for the NorCal this last year was off the charts. You know, it was our first tour event. That was a big leap for us, and we were very excited to have you guys as a partner. We seeded 342 entries at the $1,100 price point, and we knew that was a relationship we wanted to continue. And then when the opportunity came available for the World Championship, we were not going to pass on that. And so it's going to be great being that destination property for all the tour stops, along with great poker that you can always expect during an Ante Up stop. The other things to do in Northern California, being relatively close to San Francisco, Lake Tahoe, there'll be a lot of things for people to see when they come out to visit.
And what I liked most about the 342 entries was it came during like one of the worst winter storms over there, like in ages too, right?
It was some tough weather. The good news is down in the foothills, we don't get any snow down here. So that's good for people that want to come and visit in the winter.
Yeah.
You do have to drive to the snow, but we do get some pretty heavy rain. But you know what? It's just the Sacramento base, the player base out here is huge. And, you know, normally players in this area, they have to drive for big events. And so that's one thing we've been very committed to, allowing people in this area to have, you know, that place right in their own backyard, that place they can call home, come here and play in some of the biggest events in the region. And also now we're seeing people travel quite a distance. We are absolutely committed to making sure that the events here are as good as you'll find anywhere.
Well, obviously we're still quite a ways from the World Championship, but do you have any thoughts or what you think you'll be offering players for that series at this point?
We're going to offer a little bit of everything. Actually, Scott and I were talking about that. You know, you name the event, it's on the table. The main event will be a very deep structure. We're looking at a 1650 price point. It'll be, you know, monster field. Along with that, you know, our opening weekend, we normally open with a multi-day event. Right now we're doing 150K deep stack at the start of most of our series. That's actually our most popular event. Has a buy-in of 425, guarantee of 150. For our last series we just held, we seeded 593 players. Mm-hmm. And also the first weekend and the main events also include a live stream final table, which has also been very popular.
Excellent. And I think you mentioned that if I can help you out, you're going to try to work in an open-faced Chinese for that event, right?
We are looking at Open Face Chinese. Last year, I was we were on the same podcast, and I was talking with Chris, and Chris goes, "So you're having an Annie Up or an Annie Only event here for the our first NorCal?" And I said, "Not this one, but next year we'll have it." And Chris, I held true to that promise.
Yes.
We do have an Annie Only event here in the next NorCal, but we are looking to grow and add different events, especially ones that are so popular in poker. And Chinese poker is definitely that,
awesome.
And especially something with the World Championship. I was talking with Scott, and we think that that would be a great event. It would likely be our first Chinese poker event, but I'm pretty confident we're going to have that included in the schedule.
Sweet.
And we should mention here as well that we will have plenty of other tour stops announced on the events. And at each one of them, the winner of the main event will win a seat in the Annie Up World Championship out of Thunder Valley, so folks don't have to travel very far to get an opportunity to make it out to the World Championship. All right, so Ben, let's shift gears here a little bit. Your room has been on such a meteoric rise in the past year or so. I remember when I first came out and had lunch with you, and we were just two guys talking, and then ever since then, it's been crazy. You had the Annie Up Poker Tour stop last year. Obviously, you have our next one coming up this year. You just finished hosting a wildly successful Heartland Poker Tour event. How did all this happen so quickly for you?
You know what? You said it right there. We started seeing a big demand for the game. You and I sat down a couple of years ago, and that's when I looked and I saw a partnership, a magazine, someone we could work with us as we started gearing towards this. Never really seen this level of success, but definitely geared towards trying to offer bigger events. And so we did a little bit on our own. Once we made that step, that's when we partnered with you guys. And that really was the NorCal for us last year. That was a big deal. First tour stop, and we saw, hey, we can draw the people here like the events. You know, the property is absolutely committed to these large-scale poker events. And following up that, we ended up signing the deal with Heartland. And that was an incredible experience having them. What a great group of people to work with. We had 542 entries for our first event. We set a one-day record for them. We did 301 entries on the Saturday. That was a single-day record for them. Tour's been around 9 years. The biggest thing we had was trying to figure out how do we feed all the people. And that's one thing that we're going to definitely make some adjustments is we have them back in January.
Oh, that's crazy. Okay, so, you know, most immediately is this year's Annie Up NorCal Classic. 13 events with a total guaranteed prize pool of $500,000, ending, of course, with the $1,100 main event, and the winner of which will appear on the cover of our prestigious magazine, Annie Up. So what's in store for players this year?
Well, we got a full schedule of events, and that, as you guys said, starting on Thursday the 7th, we have a pretty popular event we've been using for some of the series that we kick off on a Thursday night. It's a 175 by $20,000 guaranteed deep stack. That gets things rolling. We draw right around 220 to 240 players for that normally.
Nice.
And then we'll go into that first weekend. That's the 425 by the $150,000 guaranteed deep stack. Has 3 day ones. Has a Friday morning, a Friday evening, and then the one on Saturday, and then 7.5% of the field will come back and play on the day two. That's November 10th, and then that will include a live stream final table. We have been working with Garrett Roth, your NorCal ambassador. He's been a great help on those live streams, and he'll likely be there with us along with Scott, which will be great. But we do have the Scott Long Horse event. He is our reigning champion here at Thunder Valley. That'll be on Monday. That's Monday at 1 p.m. You know, that's just that tournament right there. It draws, you know, that group of players that's looking for something a little different. The one thing we're always really committed to is the variety of games. And so the series has the horse, has an Omaha. Actually, we have the Omaha action out here for eight or better. Pretty big pool of players for that. So we're actually going to offer a deep stack event on that same day, the Monday. It'll be in the evening. At 5 o'clock, a 150 by $10,000 guarantee, Omaha 8 or better, along with the six-handed, which is always a great field, very fun event, definitely a players event. That's on Tuesday the 12th, and then we lead towards the main event. The one thing that we actually have added this last year, we started doing a deep stack black chip bounty event for a $300 buy-in, $100 bounties with a $20,000 prize pool guarantee. That's another field that's anywhere between 150 to 200 players. But people really enjoy that in the series. And then we get ready for the main event, which has the $250,000 prize pool guarantee. And that starts on Friday, November 15th. 20,000 starting chips, 40-minute blinds during day one, hour blinds on day two. And then we'll finish it up on Monday, November 18th with that live stream final table.
You have to do me a favor. If Scott gets close to chopping, don't let him chop any event that he plays in.
And no problem there. Hey, Scott's a warrior. You know, and he's in the trenches. He just saw him last year, focused and ready to take down the prize there.
Yeah.
So, but it was a lot of fun. It's great having him in the event. People enjoy playing with him, and it means a lot to have him participate. You know, in fact, he plays in a lot of the events. You know, it's the other ones. He was nice of him. You know, he only cashed in the one. He played in many. So that was, you know, players think that that's just wonderful. But you know, but the horse was a lot of fun, and I know it was great for the guys to play with Scott, and it was. Pretty unique for him to be able to win it, and people are excited. People are asking about him coming back and playing that again, giving him a chance to defend that crown there.
Well, don't let him give a lame excuse like, I have to catch a flight.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And,
no,
and
that's okay, because once he's here, he can't leave.
That's so right. So
we got that all figured out.
Excellent.
So, Ben, I want to bring this up because one of the things that I love about you is that you're constantly trying to make your stuff better, and that seems...
Ben.
Like, it's, you know, like everybody would be doing that, but not everybody does that, to be honest. And you're constantly talking to players after the event, talking to other people, traveling around the country, talking to tournament directors, and refining your stuff. And I know just last week you just blew my phone up with a text of all the things that you learned from the last event and what you're changing this year. Do you want to talk about some of those and your overall just why player feedback is so important to you?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, it's like anything else. You know, we always hear, we take the approach, if I was the player playing in the event, what would I want? And so we look for those things, the opportunities we can to really enhance the event. It's not necessarily making an adjustment that curtails to an individual. It's what's best for the overall game. And so, you know, like anything else, when people see their feedback turn into, you know, changes on upcoming events, it's just received extremely well. Along with Matt Savage, down at Commerce, he's been great to us. Had me down last March for the LAPC, the $10,000 buy-in WPT event. And that was an excellent experience. Just being able to be exposed to that level of event, along with the professionalism and everything that comes along with that. So we try to do the same thing up here. We're training our staff. We have a staff that's very dedicated to wanting to make things better. But some of the things we do after some of the series, we'll take players out to dinner and just kind of see what they have to say. But we're really looking for those fine touches. You know, at this point, it's the details. And but in the player point of view, you know, those details are what really make or break the event in the long term. And some of the things that we've adjusted, and this was one of the couple of these are pretty big. When we're on the money bubble now, and we've adopted this in all of our events, the all-in hands are not shown until all the other action at the other tables is completed. And that was something we started with the HPT, and it's a difference maker. Also, in multi-day events, when they go hand for hand on the bubble, we do a maximum of 30 minutes on the clock, then the clock is stopped until we lose that player. And so that's also something that's been received extremely well by the players, along with a lot of other small things. You know, high carding when we're breaking tables. We high card now. We make sure the tournament director mixes them in front of the players to view. This is something that, you know, the players expect in the bigger events. We now do them in all of them. But the list goes on, and that's the one thing they see. You know, when they see their feedback turn into changes, it's just been received well. And so because of that, we get great feedback, and people know that we're dedicated to making things better.
Is there, this is probably difficult to answer, but is there like a system that you would use to analyze these sort of comments and things and say, okay, X amount of people are saying we need to keep Scott Long from playing in any of these events or whatever?
Yeah.
I mean, is there a way that you say, oh, these guys are just, they're just wacky, they're daft? Or is it, hey, we really need to look at this seriously? At what point do you say, okay, this is something we need to change?
Well, the number one thing we do a lot of research. I do a lot of looking at your bigger properties. I see what the WSOP does, you know, what Savage does down there at Commerce, and along with the WPT. We look at the major properties, Borgata, for example. You know, anyone that holds the bigger events, Venetian, constantly looking at the things that they're doing, checking in with the people at these properties and finding out. Because really what we're on board with is meeting industry expectations. We want you, when you come here to play in a big event, it's no different than these other places. You know, some things are small house rule deviations, but as far as how the tournament is run and how it's executed, we want you to come here and have the same experience. And that's really what our goal is when we get that feedback, and that's really how it's analyzed through those bigger properties.
Very good.
All right, Ben. Well, we appreciate you being on the show. We definitely appreciate the relationship that Antiup is forging with Thunder Valley. Definitely look forward to it growing as well, too. I want to remind all of our listeners to visit antiuppokertour.com for more details on all these events. And a reminder, I'll be at Thunder Valley myself November 11th through the end of the series. Obviously, as we mentioned, defending my horse title. And playing a few other events as well, too. Hopefully probably helping out Ben with the final table live stream of that main event, too, which is one event I will not be in because I cannot play a 1650. We definitely hope to see lots of Antiup fans out there. I know I saw a bunch last year, so hopefully we'll see even more this year. Ben, any last thoughts? Anything you want to let the folks know before we let you go?
Just want to welcome everyone out to the series. I can promise you that you'll be impressed with what you'll see. Know that we're dedicated to these events and excited to have Antiup back. We'll see you soon.
Excellent. Thanks, Ben.
Okay. Thank you guys very much for having me on.
All right. If you find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and you're not sure what the proper ruling should have been, email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com and we'll have our veteran poker room manager, Jody Russell, tell you how he would have ruled. This one comes from Drew, one of our champions on our cruises.
Our adopted son, I think.
He said, I was playing in a 7-card stud game at Connecticut Casino. Low card brings it in, a few people limp, and the bring-in, forgetting that he was the one who brought it in, mucks his down card. Mucks his down cards, but he leaves his other cards staying up. Dealer says his card must stay on the table since it's paid for, but the player is no longer in the hand. After a player bets on Fifth Street, the dealer mucks the ghost player's card. Since poker is a 5-card game, what would have happened if everyone had checked all streets down and the ghost player had the 5 winning cards in the end? Was the dealer correct to say that the player was out of the hand when he mucked his whole cards, or that his up card should have stayed since it was paid for?
All right, Jody says, the dealer did everything correctly. To win a pot in any poker game, a player must have a complete hand at showdown. Although we only consider the best 5 of 7 this particular game, players must have all 7 cards to be eligible to win the pot.
Yeah, it's weird they keep dealing to that. I remember that's happened a few times in my career. They keep dealing to the person even though they're gone or out. And it's like, but that would have been my card, that makes sense. It's just really
what's
bizarre.
Interesting is, I should have followed up with Jody myself about this, is if players need to have 7 cards to win the pot, which he said, which makes sense, I'm still not quite sure why we're dealing to that card.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand that it was paid for. I mean, I get that part. But the card can't help anyone. I mean, I guess you're leaving it up because for information's sake.
Right.
For other people. But then you're still dealing other cards to it. So that hand is dead, then all the cards should be dead. So maybe I'll follow up with them and get an answer for us on a future show as to why that is. But that's definitely the procedure I've seen everywhere. So
it's destiny. It's the destiny. They say I shouldn't be getting this card because that guy's still in the hand, but he can't win the hand, but I still not get that card. And it's destiny, man. I'm telling you, people believe in destiny in poker. They really do.
Well, can you imagine the fracas that would break out if a guy who accidentally mucked in this situation and this scenario went down exactly like Drew said it would, which one? I can't imagine that ever happening. But if it did, and that player had the winning hand, and the dealer had to say, no, hey, your hand's mucked. What do you mean my hand's mucked? It's right there! I could say, I would probably say, maybe I'm wrong here, but 60-70% of players would probably not understand the floor ruling in that. Probably more, even.
Yeah, more than that, probably. Because how rare has that happened, you know? Here's a question. What if it's heads up and they both muck at the same time? Where does the money go then? I don't understand where the money goes. Who gets that money? The house gets to keep the money? What happens to the money?
I don't know. You just leave it see the next pot.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, we'll just leave it in the next pot.
Or you put it on the free parking space.
Monopoly. But really, I mean, it is bizarre. Some of the stuff that these 4 people have to deal with and come up with answers to, I'm glad that there's Robert's rules and there's the TDA and everything, but bizarre stuff still happens. You know, stuff that you can't even dream up could possibly happen. Then what? I mean, it's conceivable that you don't know who mucked first, that they weren't paying attention to each other, and they both took their cards and mucked them. But they left their face-up cards. You know, I mean, that would be bizarre. What would happen?
Yeah, you know, and this was a big, not a big part of the discussion, but it there was a good chunk of it during the TDA summit this year about the how direct the TDA rules should be. And there are definitely two camps of TDA members out there. There's one that wants a rule for every single situation that you can fathomably come up with.
Right.
So you can point to it when you're explaining it to the player and say, hey, it's right here. This is what it says. And there's another group, a larger group, I think, that wants to keep it open-ended. Remember that rule number one that allows, you know, TDA to tournament director make the best decision.
Right.
And put the onus on the tournament director to actually explain it to the player and not feel like they have to back it up with something more specific, something in writing, but obviously back it up with a good thought process, you know?
Yeah.
And I think this is where I come down on it. I'm definitely in the camp of less rules, more explanation because of the scenario that you brought up and the scenario that Drew brought up. I mean, can you imagine if the document had to address every single thing?
Yes, it'd be an opus.
I mean, it would be the new War and Peace. People would say, hey, don't write me a new TDA summit. Just give me the highlights.
That's right. Give me the cliff notes of the new War and Peace. But you're right. You have to have one rule that can rule them all, kind of like Lord of the Rings. But you know that you can sort of make this sort of decision and make this sort of judgment quickly enough, so the game isn't hindered, and so that you know people can move on. But it's an interesting situation, and it's happened to all. I think everybody who's played Stead, where that you're dealing to somebody who's not there, and it's like, what are you doing? And it's really bizarre, but it seems like the right way to go. Okay, we have a brand new O'Malley's Move. Let's get to it.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I am Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at a $1, $2, no-limit hold'em cash game. There's been a lot of limping pre-flop, and we've been taking advantage of our opponent's weak play after the flop. With virtually no big pots in recent memory, we've run our stack up double. We sit with about 400. It's a full 10-handed table at this point. Under the gun folds, plus 1 folds, plus 2 calls, MP calls, MP1 calls, hijack calls, and we're in the cutoff with the 6 of spades, 5 of spades. This is exactly what we want in this situation, so we make the call. Button calls, small blind calls, big blind checks, and with $18 in the pot, we see the gorgeous 9 of diamonds, 8 of diamonds, 7 of clubs. We really hit this one hard. It's checked to the MP1, who makes it $10 to go. Hijack folds, and it's on us. With so many to act behind us and a potentially vulnerable hand, we're not going to get cute here. We triple the bet to $30. The button calls? This player loves to see flops and set traps. He also likes to bet his draws. Luckily, he started this hand with only about 200. Thankfully, the rest of the table folds. The turn is the ace of diamonds. With $88 in the pot, we've got a decision to make. The call on our flop raise worries us a little bit, but we've got a made hand, and we're going to keep up the aggression. I think a defensive bet is in order here. We make it $40 to go, and with only a slight hesitation, our opponent shoves for his remaining $165. What are we doing in this spot?
It's time for Hand of the Week. Remember to send your hands or situations to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. This week, an old friend, David Bloomberg, is back.
Yay!
And he was playing in a 1-2 no-limit hold'em cash game. Says he bought in for 200. He says, generally, this is often a loose, aggressive game, and most people consider me to be the tight player here.
Okay.
I know how that feels.
Yeah.
I am dealt ace-king offsuit in middle position. Player 2 to my right raises to 12. While this is one of my normal games, I haven't played a whole lot with this particular villain, and it's on us.
I'll call. Is that enough, or do I need like more explanation for why?
That's fine. I mean, some people would raise there, but you're just going to call.
Yeah, I think I'm going to call. because I don't always want to just be ABC with it. I don't always want to just be like, oh, I got ace king, gonna raise. You know, there are some qualities that are worth exploring, like trapping or getting away from a hand for as cheap as possible, you know, without having to put extra money in. I mean, there are ways to play this hand. You don't always have to raise with them, you know.
Right.
So I'm going to try something different this week, and I'm just going to call.
You know, I'm going to, too. And I kind of like the thought process here, because our hero, David, decides to call as well, too. And what he had to say is it's the very first hand, so I don't see any reason to re-raise at this point, especially against a player I don't know as well.
Right.
And I think that's the big thing for me, is that I think the toughest hands we play at the poker table are the first orbit or two orbit, whether it's a cash game or a tournament, when we, particularly in a room that we haven't played in or against players we've never played again. We don't have any information to go on.
That's right.
And you end up getting into these sticky situations, because half of the game of poker, as we know, is figuring out your player's tendencies. And if you have nothing to base it off of, then you end up basing it off of just what regular people should do, and I think that's a recipe for disaster. If you can avoid it, and we can avoid it here.
Now, did you tell me the suits? I can't remember.
He just said offsuit.
Okay, so. He just said offsuit. Okay, it doesn't really matter then. It's not going to come into play. Okay.
All right, so as I said, he did call. No one else calls, so their heads up, and the flop comes ace-8-5 rainbow, and our villain bets $18.
You know, I don't think there's any real draw here or worry yet. I mean, there's one thing to re-raise here or to raise and to try to take it down now. But at the same time, you're always saying, let's extract. We could scare somebody who has, say, queens or something like that, or ace-queen. So, I don't know. If I was convinced this guy had a second-best hand, but he couldn't get away from it, I might consider raising, but I might try to see what he does in the turn. I mean, I got top-top right here, and I'm in position, which is beautiful. So, let's try a call here instead of a re-raise automatically to tell him exactly what we have, player hand face-up crap. So, there's no real draw there, so they may think that we're floating when we're actually got a pretty powerful hand here. So, let's try calling.
Yeah, I love the call here. I mean, I don't think we need to poke the bear quite yet. Maybe we're losing a little bit of value. We'll find out at the end of the hand. But in general, I mean, I think it keeps our... I think we get more value out of our opponent not knowing what we have.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I think by calling, we probably signal that we have an ace. The fact that we didn't raise him pre-flop probably makes it sound like it's not ace-king, at least.
Right.
And maybe even a weaker ace at that point that's not paired with an 8 or a 5. But it keeps our opponent guessing. He's not going to really know what's going on. If we raise, then obviously we're saying an ace, and if he's got something bigger, then we're going to get into we put to a test. And if we confuddled him at all here and what he's going to do on the turn, and you're right, there's really no risk at all here, really, other than, you know, if he has an ace, having him catch up to a two pair, but he's going to catch up anyhow because he's going to call any reasonable raise we're going to make, so that doesn't really matter to me. Or if he's got some kind of pair and he gets lucky and hits his set, but we can't really be worried about that, right? So,
right, because we've given him no information, really. We've merely called a raise in position and called a bet in position. We could go any way with this hand on a turn, and they could read into that any way they want, and it most likely will be not what we have, so I like the deception, at least right now. It could hurt us, but we'll see.
The other thing, too, about calling, too, is it may not signify that we have an ace. Maybe we've got a small pair or something that we're just scared of the ace and happy to see another card hit our set. So,
yep,
I mean...
You know. And the other thing, too, is when you call here in position, you're also saying, all right, I have something. I'm not sure you have something, which is why I'm just calling, but what you do on the turn is going to tell me whether or not I think you actually have something. And so I don't necessarily have to have an ace in my hand here. I could just have even something like king queen, thinking that if you don't hit, you don't know I didn't hit, and I could take it away from you, just float. So there are a lot of paths that you could be taking by just calling here, and you're leaving all the decisions up to them rather than you. So I like the call.
Yeah. All right, well, here it says, I feel like this is a continuation bet, and I am sure I'm ahead. I put him on a worse ace. I have position. I don't see any flush or straight worries, so I just call.
Now, here's a problem for me. Why do people call it a continuation bet if they believe the person's hit the hand? Like, my understanding is a continuation bet, every bet is a continuation bet, no matter what then.
That's true.
Because it's continuing the bet. But, I mean, when you say it that way and then you say you hit the ace, it's kind of like, no, it's not a continuation bet usually implies that they've missed. They're just doing it because they have control of the hand. They're keeping control of the hand. So I would think that if the guy has a weaker ace, then this is just a legitimate bet to me.
Yeah.
You know, the nomenclature that gets passed around in poker, it's just, it should be, you know, banished.
Banished. I wanted to call as well too, so I agree with the decision. The way he explained it was a little odd. Maybe it's just me, but if he's put him on a worse ace, which I don't know how you can do that right now. If you're saying it's a continuation bet, it could be anything, you know.
Yeah.
But if you put him on a worse ace, and then he goes on to say, "I have position, I don't see any flush or straight worries, so I just call." I guess maybe he's signifying that, you know, I'm trying to trap him because I think I have him beat. Maybe that's what he's saying.
Yeah, I think.
But otherwise, if I put him on a worse ace, if I really honestly thought he had a worse ace, then I would raise.
Yeah.
Because he can't put me on ace king, I don't think.
Right, because if he has two pair, it's not a worse ace. So really, why wouldn't you raise if you were convinced he had an ace?
Right.
Because he's not going to go anywhere if he hits top, the pair that he raised with, you know what I mean, or the high card that he raised with. So I would venture to guess that it is a continuation bet that he doesn't have an ace.
Right, exactly.
And that's why we're calling. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, the turn is the deuce of clubs. So our board now is ace, 8, 5, deuce. And obviously two clubs are on the board now. And now our villain checks.
Why is it obvious that two clubs are on the board?
Oh, it's not obvious.
Okay. It's possible, maybe?
It's obvious now that I told you.
Okay. Because no clubs were revealed. It could have been heart, diamond, spade on the flop.
Shut up.
Okay. And it's check to us?
It's check to us.
Yeah, I'll bet. I mean, how much is in the pot now? I forget.
Let's see, 18, 36, plus 24 is 60, 60 plus the plug bond, 63 minus the rake.
Yeah, I'll put 40 out there, 35, 40. I mean, why not, right? I mean, you've got what seems to be weakness on his part now. I mean, something bizarre could have just happened, like he turned a set, but really, or maybe even, but would he really raise with ace 5, ace 8, or ace deuce pre-flop? I don't know. So I feel like we're ahead and we need it now. We need to let him get some money, extract some money here that is on our dime, not his. So I don't know, 35, 40 maybe?
Yeah, here's the problem I think with... I think there's a problem with betting and there's a problem with not betting, which is a weird situation to find yourself in.
Right.
I think betting here, I mean, I think the sense I'm getting is that flop bet was a continuation bet. He didn't like that we called. The deuce obviously didn't help, so now he's slowing down and trying to exercise some pot control. And if we bet, he very likely might fold. We don't get any value out of it. Whereas if we check, maybe we'll induce him to bet the river and then get some value out of him without really too much risk. But so the value to me in betting, even if he folds, is that we're setting up that move so we can do it again later when we don't have ace-king in this situation.
Right.
But by not betting and just checking behind, maybe he doesn't take that bait, he doesn't bet, maybe he does, you know, spike something that helps him catch up to us, maybe he's got 5-7 or something, I don't know, and catches a 7, and then that's a problem. So I'd be interested to see what the discussion on the forum is going to be after this, because I think either way we're in a great spot. But it's risky whichever way we do, which doesn't happen all the time, I don't think.
I like to live my life by the edict that nothing ever good comes from the river. And by letting someone see the river for free when we have a really good hand, but still could be vulnerable now, I just don't like letting this person just see the river for nothing. I don't. If he's trying to exercise pot control, that means you want to do exactly what he doesn't want you to do. So.
Well, yeah, it's true. If he is trying to exercise pot control, maybe he has absolutely nothing. He's just given up on his hand.
Right.
But then if we check behind, if that's the case, and it's so hard to figure out, but if that's the case, and we check behind, then he's really going to be confounded and maybe takes another shot at the river because, hey, we check behind. Why would we check behind if he's showing down? I think the normal pattern of a hand would be for us to bet here with anything right. now that he's slowed down, right?
Right.
So the fact that we don't, I think, is curious. Maybe it's curious as in we have a monster and we're hoping to get him to bet, or maybe it's curious that we don't have anything either and we're just not confident enough.
So you think?
Remember, he doesn't have any read on us either. I mean, that's the other thing I think we always forget about when we sit down at a new table. It's not just that we don't have a read on our opponents, but they don't know us either. So
right. So you're thinking that he might take a stab at this too if we check to show weakness, and then he might bluff at it in the end when we have the best hand.
Yeah, I think there's a possibility there.
All right. Well, I still go to bet, but I see your point of there.
I think the safer move here is to bet here.
Yeah.
We feel like we have the strongest hand, and if he folds, we probably weren't going to get anything out of him anyhow, unless he did do that bluff that I'm talking about. And if he does have something small, then we get two streets of value out of it, because we're probably going to get some more out of him on the river.
There is some value to not having to show your hand, too. If you bet and take it down,
it's true.
You've won a pretty decent pot already very early on in the 1-2 game. A $60 pot is big. And, you know, you don't have to show it, so no one knows what you just did with Ace-King there. So now you can feel free to do it again later and trap again. So, I mean, there's a lot of value, I think, to betting. There's some value to not betting if you're going to know this guy's a bluffer, but you really don't. And the downside is he can catch up to you. I mean, he could have ace rag and catches up a two pair, which, you know, he's probably going to call your bet anyway, so you're not going to lose him there. But if he really has nothing, you might as well just take it down. Because what if he had something like, let's just say he had something like 6-6, and
right.
he knew that, or even 4-4, you know, or something like that, and all of a sudden now he can hit a wheel card and make a wheel, he can hit a set. So I mean, there's some value I think to betting and taking it down now, if you could, than giving this guy a free look at something that might. Now of course there's always something that can improve him enough to a second best hand that is good enough to call with, but I don't know if I want. I don't know if I, you know, it's hand of the week. It's so hard for us to do this way. You know, if I'm playing it myself, I'm betting, I think, without even thinking about it.
Yeah, I think I'd have a tough time coming back on this hand if I check behind and let him catch up. So that's another reason for your psyche, probably just to bet.
And yeah.
You're right. If he has 6-6 or 4-4, he's probably going to fold at this point, and we're not going to get any more out of him. Whereas maybe if we checked and he still didn't hit, maybe you'd take a shot at it. But I'd rather do that than risk losing the hand.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
All right. So our hero says, I consider his check to be further evidence that I'm ahead. I bet 25, figuring I'll probably take the pot right here. But he calls without seeming to think about it much.
Wonder if he's just not believing us, if he thinks we're floating with nothing, too. I mean, it's such a small bet in a $60 pot. I mean, that's, you know, that's a little more than a third of the pot, which is not a real bad pot if you're trying to extract value, I guess, if you knew you had the nuts or something like that, but you only have one pair here. I would have bet more to really see if this guy had a hand or not. 25 is not that much to ask, you know, early in a session if you have. But he could have an ace rag, too, and now catch up on us, too, in the river. That's just going to suck. But, you know, he could have hit a set, too, somewhere in there, and he's just slow playing it. Who knows?
All right, well, the river is the 9 of clubs, so our final board is ace, 8, 5, deuce, 9 with 3 clubs, and our opponent bets out 50.
Oof. I hate that. That's the other reason why I wanted to bet enough, because of the clubs. The way it was done before at Rainbow, and then I was forgetting that there's 2 clubs. You know, you do want to protect your ace king. 50 into. Was it 40? So it's 100. So it's $150 pot, 3-1 on your money. That's a perfect bet too.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
we can eliminate raising here, can't we?
Oh yeah, I'm not raising. It's just call or fold. There's no way I'm raising. I mean, the only way you could raise here is if you had, say, the ace of clubs in your hand, and you knew that this person was that smart to know that the ace of clubs is out and he can't possibly have the nuts. But if you don't have any kind of card like that in your hand, which we don't know because we just said it was offsuit, which I don't think it means anything then. So, jeez. I hate calling this much just for one pair, you know? But what could that card unless he's trying to see, that's the thing, and now you're trying to go on all these extra levels, but you don't know his player well enough to say, is he the kind of guy that would represent the club if it came, you know?
Yeah, you know, and I'm kind of working on this with my poker game too, is the fact that when I started, I didn't think enough about my decisions. Now I think, because we've been doing this for so long and talking about this, that I overthink my decisions.
Yeah.
And at this point, I don't know what the odds are we're going to put on that we have the best hand here or not, but it's no worse than 50-50, right? I wouldn't think. And we've already eliminated the fact that we were going to raise here. So to me, the fact that I don't know this guy, I see value in putting 50 bucks in here to see his hand and see how he played this particular hand, because we're so confused throughout it. And he was probably confused about it. And knowing that there's a good chance, or at least a average chance, that we won.
Yeah. Just for the record, I just don't like that $25 bet on the turn. That really hurts, because it's not enough for us to really narrow his range.
Right.
You know, I mean, if we bet like 50 or 45 or 40 or something like that and he calls, then you're thinking, okay, this guy's got to have at least an ace. And now maybe he has a flush draw. You know, maybe he has the ace of clubs, you know, something else. Or I don't know. It's just, you can't do any narrowing at all with $25 bet. To me, it's just like, all right, my pocket tens can still be good here. You know.
Let me ask you this, though. Were we trying to narrow, though? I mean, we are now, because on the river we're facing a bet from him. But back when we were first discussing, I mean, I was considering checking to try to induce him to bet into me and get some value out of his hand. So if I bet the 25 and I got the 25 out of him, that's a good day at the office, I think. It's just a problem now when he turns around and bets at us that we were not defined. But,
well, I mean, the call on the turn
not
does...
Not have felt any more comfortable betting 40 there and having him fold and not getting anything out of him. I mean, that's what's difficult about this, because we're obviously at the river now, whereas had we done that, we would have never seen a river, never been in this situation to discuss it. But I felt on the turn, I felt strongly that we were ahead. So when you're strongly ahead, you want to get some value out of the hand, and we did. It's just, I mean, I don't know. Would you have felt better if we bet 40 and he called, and now he bets 50?
I might have gotten away from it then. I don't know if I can get away from it now. If he had called a $40 bet and then bet 50, I'm beat. You know, now it's, he could be representing. It could be that he got there for free. You know, but if he had a flush draw, he might not have called with one card to come a $40 bet or a $50 bet, but he would definitely call a $25 bet. So now I'm put to decision. I think I'm beat now. Before, if he bet 40, he called 40, I would know that I'm beat, you know, or would be beat by the river with a club too. I feel like this hand now is shrunk up. I would have bet more on the turn and maybe taken it down. And had I not taken it down, this $50 bet would have been an easier fold. But I'm going to have to call now, and I just want to see what he has. I feel like we're beat, though. It really feels like this guy somehow backed into a flush draw or a two-pair, and backed into a flush draw on the turn and made it, or made two-pair with an ace-nine or something, but or maybe a set of nines. It's tough. It's tough, because what you got to go back to the beginning. What would he have raised with? Would he have raised with ace, queen of clubs? Sure.
Right.
Would he have raised with ace, nine of clubs? Or, I mean, ace, nine, and then, you know, made two pair there? Yeah. Would he have raised with nines? I don't know if he would have raised with ace, nine, but he would have raised with nines, probably. Bet a weak continuation bet, checked the turn because he was nervous, and then woke up. You know, only 25 could mean that, yeah, you don't really have an ace, you're just floating me, and my nines are better than your eights that you made, you know, or something. So there are a few hands that I could put them on. It's just now I got to put the percentages to them, and it's 3-1 on my money, enough to call with top. I mean, I guess I'm going to have to call, but grudgingly.
Okay. Well, Arhuma says, I'm sure I was ahead the whole way, but now I feel very strongly like I'm behind. I can't see him having had clubs, because the ace on the board is a club. As much as I hate to do it and make a crying call, he turns over 9-9.
9-9. Well, that was the last hand I thought of at the end. So, yeah, see, it would have helped, too, if I had known that was the ace of clubs.
Yeah.
I mean, I should have known that from the beginning, because that would have been a totally different thinking process. I wouldn't have put him on ace, queen of clubs, or, you know, I would have remembered the flush draw on the turn. So That would have been helpful. But, yeah, 9-9 made sense on the end there. And if you think about it, going from the beginning with 9-9, that makes sense too. Wow, that's weird. I put him on the hand at the end. So, but I probably still would have called, which sucks. I did feel beat, though. I did feel beat.
Yeah. No, I felt that way, too. I also felt like I could be, you know, I could still be ahead. So, and we got the information at least now.
Yeah.
Dave went on to say, I was right about being ahead on the flop and the turn. I even said it out loud and said he thought he was ahead the whole time, which makes me wonder what the heck he thought I had, such I couldn't beat pocket nines on that board. Several people have pointed out to me since then that the villain probably didn't even think about what I had, just that he had a pair. Sigh.
Well, see, now I have to disagree, though. I mean, think about it. We just did this. We just replayed this. If you have nines, you're going to raise with it. You get a call. Flop comes on an ace. You do your continuation bet. You get a call. Now you're worried that he has the ace. You know, you bet out. You check now the turn, and he only bets 25. That's a pretty weak bet to me. If you have an ace in your hand, then you're looking to protect your hand with two clubs on the board. He only bet 25. Now that you have the clubs, now that I know about the clubs, you're not protecting your hand that much. It seems pretty weak. So the nines might be good now. So he calls a mere 25 and gets lucky and hits the two outer. But it totally makes sense that he has nines. I don't think he played the nines too wrong. I mean, he did what he was supposed to do pre-flop. He did what he was supposed to do after the flop because he's supposed to represent the ace and not be scared of it. And you took control of the hand. On the turn, he checked because he was worried when he got the call. Mm-hmm. And then when you only bet 25, he felt like that was you floating and not having the real, you know, chutzpah to, you know, whatever, to make a real bet. You're just trying to steal it from me. At 25 bucks with that much in the pot, it's probably worth a call there because you think he might be just trying to steal from you with king, queen, or, you know, 8-9, 8-5.
Well, let me ask
something.
You this, because that's interesting. So if you called at 25 and the 9 didn't come on the river, are you still going to bet into me?
No, I don't think so.
Here's the thing. If you're going to call that 25, and then you just would check it and see whether I set a decent enough price for you to call again.
Well, that's the thing, is I think that by me calling the 25, he might
check behind. Well, I guess my point is that if you're going to call that 25, I think you have to either hope that you're going to hit a 9, which is unlikely, right?
Right.
Or that you're going to be able to run some sort of bluff, which is betting out the 50 here like we did, but without the set to back us up with. Or that we're planning on checking again on the river and hope that it just gets checked behind, or he bets another minuscule amount that we feel like we're likely to call. If it's not any of those things, then I think we're throwing away that $25.
Well, I think if it's a card that's under my 9 on the river, I think I would call any reasonable bet after I check. I think that if I had, if a 6 came or something, you know, it didn't give me a set, but it still gave me everything over that ace, and I didn't believe he had an ace, right, then any reasonable bet by our,
okay, so that's what I'm saying. So it's a third option that you're just assuming that, you know, you're going to check, he's going to give you a price that you can afford.
Right, we're going to pot control and hope he gives me a price that I can afford. Because if I bet 50, I sure as hell would call 50, and it's hard to imagine he's going to bet more than 50 on this river with right, just a naked ace. So I think that I would check call and hope to just check it down. And but I feel like he played this hand right. I don't think this guy with nines did anything wrong. I think, I mean, a $25 bet is a weak bet there, so there's no strength in it. It could be I'm trapping you with a set hand and just want to milk you, but it's so rare that you really think that this guy is either trying to steal it or that he didn't bet enough and you gave him the right amount of money to call given this board. I would have protected that ace-king with two clubs on there and the fact that he showed weakness. We knew that we were ahead there. Why didn't we take it down? And like I said, I hate the river. I hate giving somebody the river for free. I never want to give anyone the river for free when I think I'm ahead, unless I'm way, way, way ahead and can't be caught. You know, I just felt bad about that minuscule bet.
Right.
But, yeah, well, interesting. I mean, it felt weird that I thought of nines at the end there because of the way it came down, and he actually had nines. That's bizarre. But, you know, it makes sense. So, sorry, Dave.
All right, folks, well, pay attention to this hand because next week's Hand of the Week will also be from David using the same villain.
Ooh.
Which is kind of different, right? And we're going to two hands in a row based off the information that we learned from the villain this time.
Oh, that's cool.
That's pretty cool.
That's the first time we ever did that, I think.
I think so.
See, we're still at this age, still just trailblazing along, setting precedents. It's pretty amazing, 8 years later. remarkable. All right, I want to thank Ben Irwin for being another spectacular guest for us. Looking forward to all those awesome events out there, and love the partnership with those guys. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the table.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.